This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Sarah Miller murder case in McLean and Woodford counties has engaged a lot of public attention. Even the victim's best friend, Bobby Busick, expresses ambivalence at the four-year prison sentence for Miller.
I didn't come in with any high expectations. Like I said, Sarah's a good person under most aspects, and it was fair, at least.
A look at the sentencing hearing with GLT's Ryan Denham. Plus, the latest from the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene, and Once Upon a Mattress is once again tossing and turning in the Twin Cities. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A former Bloomington School's Spanish teacher has been sentenced to 8 years in prison for murdering her husband. Sarah Miller stabbed her husband Mark at a campground in Woodford County last year during an argument. She could be out in 4 years. The case has had significant public attention because Miller was involved in many children's lives, because it's unusual to have a wife kill a husband, and because Mark Miller's family has been relatively public about its forgiveness of Sarah. Joining us to discuss the case is GLT's Ryan Denham, who was at the sentencing hearing. Ryan, why 8 years? What were the factors that went into the judge's decision on the sentence?
Well, sure. At a case like this, you're bound to get some kind of Monday morning quarterbacking after the fact, with people kind of wondering why it happened. The defense actually wanted probation in this case, or at least probation with some maybe periodic imprisonment for a couple of years. Sarah Miller has been in jail in Woodford County since this happened. The prosecutors actually wanted a 12-year sentence, and the range really could have been between probation and 20 years in prison. Ultimately, the judge landed on 8. What he was kind of weighing was, was Sarah Miller provoked? She was confronted by her husband at that campsite. Was that provocation enough to warrant that? But also, he weighed the seriousness of the crime, stabbing somebody in the chest with a giant hunting knife. And ultimately, he landed on that 8-year term.
What makes this such an unusual case?
Well, Sarah Miller's defense attorney kind of said it herself. It's Stephanie Wong. This is not your usual second-degree murder case. She had argued in court yesterday during the sentencing hearing that the husband, the victim in this case, Mark Miller, had some behavioral issues, including some physical and verbal abuse towards Sarah. At the same time, she was arguing that Sarah is a good person. The judge said that himself, that good people do bad things. The defense brought in friends and family and co-workers at Bloomington High School of Sarah's to talk about her selflessness and her service to the community. At the same time, Sarah Miller is carrying a knife with her pretty much at all times after this 2014 attack, where she was jumped outside of her home on the Bloomington's west side. All those things put together kind of make this an unusual case. There's a lot of gray area here.
Mark Miller had grabbed her, not for the first time. Why didn't Sarah pursue a more traditional self-defense claim?
This is something a lot of people have been kind of wondering about. It would seem to make sense that you would maybe go to trial with this and actually make a case for self-defense. She was initially charged with first-degree murder after this happened back in October of 2016. Then a few months ago, she basically reached a deal with prosecutors to go down to a second-degree murder charge, which is a lesser charge, reduced sentence, that kind of thing. She pleaded guilty to that charge, so it's not like she was trying to fight it at all. Some interesting kind of side notes to this is she drove with Mark, her husband, to the hospital after it happened. Was very distraught after, very remorseful immediately. The victim's mother kind of spoke to this a little bit on the witness stand yesterday during the sentencing hearing. She hinted that Sarah maybe felt guilty enough where she almost thought that a period of imprisonment would be appropriate. She almost wanted that to some degree. So I asked Stephanie Wong, Sarah's defense attorney, about this exact question about self-defense.
Again, those are discussions that would open me up to discussions within the attorney-client privilege. And so, and based on the investigation, it's not something I can comment on.
What was the scene in the courtroom with family and friends of the Millers?
So this took place actually out in Eureka, which is the county seat for Woodford County. The murder took place at a campground that was outside of Carlock, so technically in Woodford County, which is why the court action was all out there. It was packed. They literally brought in folding chairs for the sentencing hearing. There was a mixture of family and friends of Sarah and Mark and both of them. Obviously, a very mixed bag there. The victim's mother, Jerry Andrew, who lives in Maryland, sat right behind Sarah Meller, who cried at times as her family and friends kind of took the stand and talked about her and her relationship with her husband. Some in the gallery were wearing actually matching T-shirts that said, in loving memory of Mark Meller, hunting, fishing, loving every day, it said. And it was a little bit awkward at times. There was some snickering in the gallery as people on the witness stand kind of depicted Sarah as the victim in the case, and as people talked about Mark's temper and some of his troubling characteristics, there was some snickering in the crowd. I asked Woodford County State's Attorney Greg Minger about this, kind of balancing those competing wants and needs from all the family and friends involved in the case.
There's people that are for 20 years and not satisfied with even that. There's people that are family and friends. There's family members that want probation. It's just taking account of their interests and talking to them, kind of getting a feel for that through letters or through other family members. Well, so-and-so says, you know, it should be this. And just trying to come up with an idea of where everybody's at. It's easier, obviously, if everybody's on the same page. This case wasn't that way. But ultimately, I have to look at everything and do what's right by the citizens of Woodford County and the state of Illinois and follow the law.
For the people who may not know much about the legal system, they're listening to this and they're saying to themselves, you know, she was remorseful immediately. She said she loved him. She rode with him in the ambulance to the hospital. Clearly, she didn't intend to take his life. Why is it murder and not manslaughter?
That's a very good question. That's a question that really only the Woodford County State's Attorney and the defense attorney in this case can answer. It seems, you know, kind of like a no-brainer there, but obviously this case is just full of nuance and gray area that's really what makes it so compelling.
What do we know about Mark Meller?
Well, a lot of the attention in the case is kind of focused on Sarah Meller, obviously, but it's important to keep in mind that Mark was a living, breathing person too, and he had family and friends. The defense yesterday at the sentencing hearing was trying to paint him as a kind of a short-tempered, stressed-out guy about his job, prone to outbursts. He would apparently punch walls all over his house when he was mad, and Sarah Meller would go around fixing the holes in the wall. He allegedly spit on her at a bar once during a fight in view of her teaching colleagues. He allegedly threatened her during a canoe ride that very weekend at the campsite shortly before he was murdered. Smoked a lot of pot. So obviously people are kind of depicting him in a certain way. But Sarah herself, took to his defense during the sentencing hearing and talked very lovingly about him. She said that they would go to that campsite and that river there. That was his solace to try to adjust his mood in a positive way. So even that has some context behind it. A really important factor that the defense worked on yesterday was Mark's job at McLean County Animal Control. A couple of years ago, you may recall there was a case in which some pit bulls mauled a 4-year-old girl to death. And apparently Mark was, you know, one of the first people to respond to that and saw a lot of it and saw how gruesome that was and made quite an impact on him. And people say it changed him. His mother, who's in the Navy, actually talked about, you know, wondering if he had PTSD in some sense just from that episode. His best friend, Bobby Busick, testified during the sentencing hearing. Afterward, he said he was relieved. I asked him about Mark and to talk about him a little bit.
He was a brother, you know, my brother, my best friend for my entire life. And I know during the court case, they kept talking about, you know, his work for animal control and the stress that caused. And you know, during the court case, they were trying to paint Sarah as, a victim, and it makes sense. And they didn't do a bad job. They weren't trying to bash on Mark too much, you know, other than the stress and the actions that the stress caused him. So But in general, he was a great person, lots of fun. He loved outdoors activities and hunting and fishing. He spent most of his life doing that more than anything else. He slept better in a tent than he did in his house.
What Bobby Busick just talked about was painting Sarah as a victim. Why wasn't there more of that? I mean, the bashing the walls, the threats, the physical restraint, isn't that a just made to order for a domestic violence defense?
No, and that was the centerpiece of Stephanie Wong, the defense attorney's, the centerpiece of her, not a case yesterday, but her argument for probation. She called Sarah the, quote, poster child of a community-based sentence, which would mean probation. But Judge Michael Stroh, Associate Judge Michael Stroh, just didn't buy that fully and felt that some prison time was going to be required here and again settled on that 8-year term, which could mean Sarah Mellor is released in 4 years with day-to-day credit and good behavior and those types of things.
What else do we know, should we know, about their relationship before the stabbing?
It's obviously really hard to tell at a relationship, to look at a relationship from the outside, especially a relationship that we've only seen in a few different court hearings. But it was clearly a very volatile relationship that was at times very loving as well. There was testimony about some epic shouting matches between the two of them in view of family and friends. She'd get so frustrated with him that she'd actually run home the 20 miles from the campsite out near Carlock.
That's a runner.
Yeah, and she was a marathon runner, so I mean it was obviously physically doable for her, but obviously they ran into each other so much out there that she would just run home. But everyone who testified said that they loved each other, and Sarah said that herself during her statement. She encouraged him to take college classes and helped him with his resume to try to get a new job. After that animal control job really stressed him out. Right after that, though, she talked about how he had choked her and tackled her and put a pillow over her head and threatened her during that canoe ride. So obviously a lot happening under the surface that bubbled up in this episode.
GLT Digital Director Ryan Denham covered the sentencing hearing for Sarah Mellor, who stabbed her husband Mark to death last year. Thanks for joining us, Ryan.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, foodies, get ready. It's the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene. Fans of fairy tales are in luck this summer. The Little Mermaid is based on a Hans Christian Andersen story. It's on stage this weekend at Bloomington's Community Players. And July 27th through the 30th, the Miller Park Summer Musicals program will present Once Upon a Mattress, a show based on the fairy tale The Princess and the Pea. GLT's Judy Valente has more about the Miller Park production and why this year's show is special.
Someone's being bashful. That's no way to be. Not with me. Can't you see that I am just as embarrassed as you? And I can understand your point of view. I've always been shy.
Once Upon a Mattress is the story of an unhappy prince named Dauntless who struggles to free himself from his domineering queen mother so he can find his princess bride. He falls for a princess who is far from shy in a role originated on Broadway by comedienne Carol Burnett. The actor who plays the prince in the Bloomington production is Oscar Urquizo, an incoming senior at University High School. He started playing in summer musicals when he was 7, and this is his 10th production. The director for Once Upon a Mattress is Tricia Stiller, executive director of the Downtown Bloomington Association. Stiller says this summer's production has special significance. It's being dedicated to a beloved figure in the Bloomington Normal arts community who passed away earlier this year.
This was a joint decision, my dear friend Tina Salamone, the late manager of the Performing Arts Center. She and I were looking at possible scripts for this summer. We've collaborated a couple of years now, and this one in particular was very dear to her. She had a personal relationship with it when she was just starting out as a young actress. She was in a stage production playing the role of Princess Winifred, and then later she revisited the script as an adult and played the role of Queen Agravain. So she was very excited to bring this to the community and share her personal insights, and I'm honored to be able to continue that for her.
So it's kind of an homage to Tina Salamone in a way.
That's how we're looking at it, absolutely.
It's a very quirky story, but it does have resonances with current issues. Can you tell us a little bit about the story?
I think, yes. I mean, we hear a lot today about helicopter parenting and over-insulating a child. Well, there's no better character to bring that to life than our Prince Dauntless, whose nickname is Dauntless the Drab. His mother, the Queen, refuses to allow her only child to grow up and leave the nest, and that truly is the center core of the story that we're telling. So that is relevant. You'll get to see Prince Dauntless, who's sitting right next to me, find his own way.
That is right. You brought with you Oscar Urquizo, who plays the prince in the production. Oscar, this is your 10th year with Summer Musicals. What are the other roles that you've played?
Well, in my very first production with Trisha 10 years ago, I played Cui in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
How old were you then?
7 years old.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, Cui was the timid, shy little dwarf, and I guess now I'm the timid little shy prince.
Okay. What other roles have you had over the years?
I've had ensemble roles. One of my favorite years, we did Cats, and I was Mungo Jerry.
Okay. What has the Summer Musicals taught you?
I've made a lot of great friends. I've learned how to manage time, and I've also just learned how to work in a team and work in a group environment.
Do you think you'll go on in theater?
Yeah, I will. And I'll hope to participate in productions in college and when I'm an adult.
Trisha, is this something you hear a lot from the players, the young players who are in the Summer Musicals?
I do, actually. You know, it's kind of 50-50. We have young people whose parents are trying to help them find their way, whether they're athletic or creative, and find a way to nurture those natural gifts that are emerging. And then we have those who, there's no doubt that this is a child who has that passion. We've had kids come through our programs, whether through Parks and Rec or the Summer Theater Program or Community Players, and who are now working professionals because we saw that spark when they were very, very young. So we're very, very fortunate in this community to have these opportunities, and it is a solid foundation that takes them and serves them well.
Sometimes the directors say it's difficult to get boys involved and young men involved in the theater. What would you say to them, Oscar, based on your experience?
It's worth a shot. Like, it's fun. I've been in athletics before, and it's nice to have a well-rounded knowledge of everything. You know, you're able to express yourself in different ways that you wouldn't be able to on a normal day. Like, you get to wear costumes and you get to be somebody else that you aren't, and it's pretty fun.
I just want to speak to that last point that Oscar made. I think there's nothing that fosters empathy better than theatrical experiences, because you truly are forced to see life from your character's perspective. So you gain all these different insights based on what experience you're involved in. And there are relationships and an unconditional acceptance in the creative world that you might not find in other realms. Often we will meet a young man because he's dragged by a sibling or a friend, and they end up coming back year after year because they just didn't know.
You've been in 10 productions. This will be your 10th. People on the stage often have stories about near misses, near catastrophes. Do you have any memorable experience in the summer theater?
I think I actually remember it was Peter Pan, and it was Friday the 13th, and I think one of the curtain bars fell on someone's head. But I think that was the closest thing that's ever happened.
I can tell you some horror stories. We were doing a production of Oliver, and the young actor playing our Artful Dodger, which is an integral role, had a ruptured appendix, and we had to replace him immediately for not only that performance, but the remainder of the run. And that's not something you can plan for.
Oh, my goodness.
Luckily, he made a full and complete recovery, and we're grateful for for that, but that was not something we had hoped to happen. So.
Well, getting back to your current production, Once Upon a Mattress, it is not what I would say one of the most famous Broadway shows, but it played on television a number of times. There were two or three, at least, television productions of it, and the Broadway production introduced Carol Burnett to stage audiences. This is well before her own famous Carol Burnett show.
The production made its Broadway debut in 1959, and a very young Carol, who was probably Oscar's age, made her Broadway debut. And it was there that Lucille Ball saw Carol and helped her get her start in show business. Lucille Ball attended the performance that Carol was, when she was very young, she played Princess Winifred, and just like our friend Tina, later went on to play Queen Agravaine in the television production of the show.
Well, I'm glad they all lived happily, happily, happily ever after. The couple is happily leaving the chapel eternally tied. As the curtain descends, there is nothing but loving and laughter.
Oscar, this is a show that originated in 1959, and here you are in 2017 playing in it. How does it speak to you in 2017?
It does explore different topics that are issues today, such as bullying and helicopter parents and people being pressured into things they probably don't want to be pressured in.
Poor Dauntless, his mother is incredibly controlling, and to the point where she dismisses him completely and doesn't often listen to him or his wishes. And I think, you know, whether you're a young person or even in adult life, you have situations where there are very strong personalities who quite often don't allow your voice to be heard at the table. And I think that's a universal theme. And yeah. And finding the self-love and self-respect enough to finally stand your ground and say, hey, that's not acceptable. And I think that's very current. And I think it's a timeless theme that's worthy of exploring. And I think Oscar does a fantastic job of representing that in Prince Dauntless.
Tricia Stiller is the director of the Miller Park Summer Musical this year, Once Upon a Mattress. Oscar Urquizo has one of the leading roles. Thank you both for coming in and talking about the show.
Thank you so much for having us, Judy.
I'm Judy Valente.
I never felt better in my life. Everybody, 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 come and meet my incipient wife.
Once Upon a Mattress is on stage in Miller Park, July 27th through the 30th, with evening performances at 7:30 each of those days and 2 p.m. matinees on Saturday and Sunday. You can hear more songs from Once Upon a Mattress and other Broadway musicals tonight at 7 on GLT's center stage. Here's the original Broadway cast recording of a singing song of love.
I'm in love with a girl named Fred. She sings just like a bird. You'll be left completely speechless when her gentle voice is heard.
Support for GLT comes from Connect Transit, connecting you in new ways, 7 days a week with new Sunday routes. Riders can track buses in real time with the Connect Transit app for Android or iPhone. Information at connect-transit.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A pizza place, one American/Chinese/Filipino place, and a barbecue establishment. Those are among the restaurants changing on the scene in Bloomington Normal. Larry Carius starts the restaurant scene with recent restaurant closures.
The Grand Cafe is closed. A local person, Jimmy Mapugay, purchased it. The day he took over, he closed it. He's having plans drawn up right now. There's going to be a major remodeling done. He said when he reopens, he will keep the traditional Grand Cafe menu items, but he's also going to add some Filipino items. But we're not going to see this reopen until, I would say, at least late this fall, Charlie, maybe even as late as the first year or so.
Stolfus Pizza has also given up the ghost.
Well, I'm not sure if giving up the ghost is the correct term on that, Charlie. Tony Stolfa has a very successful Stolfa landscaping. During the summertime, he works a tremendous number of hours. the pizza place, he told me, was a successful restaurant, but Tony said that he's got three young children. He's a softball coach. He's a basketball coach. He needed help in the landscaping business, so he closed the restaurant. The restaurant is for sale. His head chef and the cooks and a couple of other people are working for him this summer in the landscaping business. Now, Tony told me we may not have seen the last of him in the pizza business. He expects, or maybe I say hopes, to someday get back into it. And instead of just having a carryout place that he has now, he would like to have a sit-down pizza place where that he can serve beer.
And on the west side, there's been a closure.
Jaisal Barbecue closed, and I was really disappointed when this closed. Rev Jackson III, he's an excellent cook. He opened Jaisal, I think, about a year ago. It's kind of been a struggle for him. The location, I don't think, is the best location. But he was surviving. He was doing okay until the railroad people shut down Washington Street. And if you know where the location of Jaisal is, it's right next to the track. They had originally only planned on closing it about a week. Well, that week extended into 6 weeks or so, or maybe even longer. The business dried up, and he just could not survive with the railroad crossing being closed. Since he was kind of on the edge anyway, the railroad crossing being closed finished him off. He's been in the food truck business. I think we may see him come back someday.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene with Larry Carius. How about the openings? A couple of small, niche places that are not full service, but are quite interesting.
Charlie, what I found interesting was when Teresa's Italian Ice opened. I interviewed the owner. He's originally from Philadelphia, grew up on the East Coast, spent a lot of time on the Jersey Shore. He and his family came to Bloomington about 3 years ago. He's a very, very successful gentleman. Doesn't play golf, doesn't do any of those things. So when he was working on the Jersey Shore many years ago in college, they were serving what they call the Philadelphia water ice. Now, when I did the interview and I asked him what you are serving, he was saying something like Philadelphia water ice. And I have just a little hard of hearing. And I... You know, I'm sorry, Ed, what'd you say? And he said it again.
Wooter.
And he said, serving Philadelphia Wooter ice. And I was a little embarrassed, but I said, how do you spell that word Wooter? He said, it's W-A-T-E-R. Oh, water ice. Well, out in Philadelphia, it's called water ice. That's a Philadelphia accent.
Cool.
And anyway, he has the same machines, the same flavor that's being sold out there in the Jersey Shore.
And that is on Old Fort Jesse Road, just near Fort Jesse Cafe.
Yes, it is. It was Java Joe's Coffee Shop.
We're talking with Larry Carius, who writes about the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene on Facebook. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas. On the west side, there's also an opening, although how do you find it?
You're talking about the White Oak Tap Room. Brian Bellard, he's worked for quite a while, and he has the White Oak Brewery going. He built a tap room on the side of it. And it's not a large tap room. It'll hold 22 to 25 people, but it's just a neat place. And I've stopped by there a couple times. Whenever I'm there, there's a lot of people. Now, where to find it? I think for some of the old timers, if they know where Old Route 150 is, which I think is called White Oak Road now, everybody knows where Swingers is. I think it's between Swingers and Vernon Avenue. I tell people there was a landscaping business building that burned there several years ago. If you turn east at that corner and go to the end of the street, the parking lot there is for the White Oak Brewery.
And if beer is liquid bread, then we should move on to a bakery.
I'm a huge fan of downtown Bloomington. Ivy Lane Bakery, Susan Gechner. She always enjoyed baking at home, and she became quite well known for her cookies and some other products. She took over the former Craven Donuts, and from what I understand, she is doing quite well.
And in Uptown Normal, there's an opening, too.
Uptown Pizza has opened. This is the location for those of us that have been around town for a while. This is the same location where at one time you would have found Dirk's Pizza, you would have found Rhino's Pizza, you would have found Prime Time Pizza. Lately, it has been a non-India, and now a local person has taken it over, and he's put in Uptown Pizza.
That was also Grog's at one time?
It was Grog's also.
Moving back to dough. Tell us about Crawford's Corner Pub.
Crawford's Corner Pub is in the former Benigno's building on the Bloomington near West Side. Bob Crawford and his partner, Larry Salvador Jr., they are West Side people. Bob grew up a couple blocks away. Both of them have businesses on the West Side. Bob has always wanted to own a tavern, so they purchased a Benigno's building, literally went in and gutted it from wall to wall. The only existing piece of equipment still there from Benigno's is the cook line hood. They did a great job of remodeling it.
Next week on Sound Ideas, hear more about the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene and a slew of restaurant plans in the works. Larry Carius writes about the Twin Cities eateries on Facebook. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're in for more oppressive summer weather this week, with a heat advisory in effect until Saturday evening. This type of weather is vexing for humans, but what about your lawn? Patrick Murphy, host of GLT's Grow, has the answer.
When the heat is on and the rains are not, lawns can shut down. But does dormancy lead to death? I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice. From our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Howdy do.
Howdy do indeed. Today on GLT's Grow, Janine in Bloomington has a question about lawn dormancy. Now, she says during a recent hot, dry spell, we get these in central Illinois, she says, as expected, our turf went dormant, but we did not expect parts of the lawn to die. She says, what's up?
Well, I think that you're encountering something that is more and more common. The summers are getting hotter and longer, but that's kind of the bad news, I guess, if you don't like summer. I do like it. But
I don't.
But turf dormancy is normal, and in cool season grasses, it's essential for them to survive. And I always draw on my experience as a landscape professional. I can tell you that around this time every year, the garden center phone starts ringing and the questions pile in, just like we received a question. That's very ironic.
Mm-hmm.
And expected, right? So, but here's the deal. So all turf grasses, so you got your warm season grasses, you got, you know, so Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, Florida, Roll Tide. And you have utility turfs, turfs that are planted along roadsides and on hillsides, the rough at the golf course.
Yeah.
It's the creme de la creme of the utility turfs. Those are the grasses that are used to kind of control erosion and access and things like that. They all do this. Down in the south, Roll Tide, they go dormant a little bit when it's cold out. So it's kind of the opposite.
Okay.
And dormancy is really just a resting phase in the growth of a turf grass. And it's brought on by an increase of heat, the occurrence of drought, and cold.
Uh-huh.
So you can have a cool season grass experience turf dormancy because of three of those things. So our turf takes a beating. And even if you examine a list of all the turfs, and these are the kinds we walk on, as well as the utility turfs I mentioned for roadsides and hillsides, the grasses that are most common in the south, they have excellent performance when it comes to not going dormant in the summer. Whereas here in the Midwest, where Kentucky bluegrass is king and the fescues are also very popular, you're in the very good to good range. So that means you're going to encounter the dormancy no matter what.
Uh-huh.
But I think you can keep yourself out of trouble if you know a couple of things. right? So if you're noticing your lawn is brown and sometimes it can get so thin that it appears it's dead, and it's so thin that you can see cracks in the soil even through the thatch layer. And that grass will come back. As soon as college football stuff starts showing up on TV, that grass...
Go Redbirds.
Yeah, go Birds. And that by then, you'll see it come around. And then it also draws on advice that we've given folks lots of times about watering. It's the deep and frequent watering that makes your lawn stronger, and it's also the best approach to keep you out of the trouble from developing another disease during the hot season, and that's deep and frequent watering. And you do that without a sprinkler, usually. You would let the hose run on the ground and let the water go to the ground where it's taken up. It's not taken up as it blows through the air. It's taken up when it reaches the roots.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, lawn dormancy. I mean, should we just not water our lawns when the lawns go dormant? Should we just go, okay, go dormant and leave it alone and not do anything with it and just let nature take its course?
I like that practice.
Okay.
But so it's easy to stop mowing, especially when it's blazing hot outside, right? But you might have to mow the edges. But don't mow the parts of your lawn, because sometimes there are areas that are near the shade or downhill of an elevation where water collects, where the grass avoids the dormancy. Well, you can mow those areas and stay off the others. Now, what's another thing that occurs a lot of times in the summer? County fairs, barbecues at our house. You have a bunch of friends over to sit by the fire because the evenings are so wonderful sometimes in the summer. It's not that hot.
Yep.
Well, don't have all your guests park on the grass. The grass is really delicate and sensitive. And, you know, I always think about that when the county fairs and the state fairs run into town, because, you know, they'll quit mowing the grass for a little while before they're going to have all the cars park in the grass fields.
Uh-huh.
And then they'll cut the grass and let all the clippings lay there. And that's typically by design to help the ground withstand the compaction of the vehicles and their feet. And then all that thatch that they cut from letting it grow tall, it protects the ground also from direct sunlight. When you think about your grass going dormant and it's time to cut it again or leading up to that, it kind of reinforces mowing heights. You want to go with a taller mowing height as the heat approaches until you kind of stop mowing for a little while. And sharp blades are really important, because you can go out there and mow with the dull blades and beat up the grass, and that's a type of stress too.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's the thing I was thinking about. How do you know your grass is going dormant? And you know, one of the best ways to tell is kind of take a look at what's discharging from the mower as you're mowing. Compare what was coming out of the discharge in May to what's coming out now. There's a big reduction in the amount of clippings, because all of those grasses aren't growing, just some of them, right? And then the deep and frequent waterings are more economical and effective, because the in between the waterings, the roots have to dive and search for the water more so than if it was a frequent daily sprinkling from an irrigation system, which oftentimes leaves the roots really close to the surface and even more susceptible to the heat stress.
Absolutely. Well, is it possible, though, that what Janine is experiencing with her grass dying, maybe that's not dormancy? Is there something out there that might have just killed off a patch of grass?
Well, if you went out and mowed dormant grass and you know, did the spritzeling type ineffective watering, you could actually make things worse.
Oh.
But before I would run out and engage in a turf restoration project in the middle of the summer, I would let time pass and make sure, because I've seen some pretty rough stuff come back and turn green.
As
the students return to campus, it seems like there are parts of the quad that just come alive, you know. And
I joke about how my lawn, you know, when the summertime gets crunchy, you know, because it's gone dormant. But it comes back every fall. It comes back every spring and looks great until we get to, like, the late June time period. And then it starts looking, you know, kind of road hard and put away wet and that sort of thing. So, you know, just patience is really important.
Yeah, you have to just live with it, you know. And if you have a lawn that has a an earthen berm that has turf on it, you'll see that the berm is going dry a lot faster than everything else that's on a flat plain. It's elevated. The water runs off of it. It might even be pitched in a way that it's getting maximum amount of sunlight and reflective light. there's no coincidence that the ditch edges and the high ground turns brown and dull first, and then you see the cracks and all that stuff. But it's not the end of the world, really. It does happen. And the actual physiological response is when photosynthesis exceeds the respiration rate. So the plant's growing to make carbohydrates, and when it's really hot, the cool season grasses are getting rid of a lot of that faster than it can be made. So that's why the grass goes dormant. It's a defense mechanism.
Okay. Well, you know, sometimes I like to do that on a really hot day, too.
Yeah.
Next week on GLT's Grow. By the way, thank you so much, Janine, for your question. We've got another question next week. Comes from Marilyn in Normal, who is wondering about her flowering crab tree. And it's having some problems, and she thinks the possibility might be that it's stressed. So we're going to talk about that next week on GLT's Grow. If you've got a gardening question, we'd love to hear from you. Just go to our website and submit it, wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Springfield native Jesse W. Johnson writes and produces infectiously melodic pop rock. Now living in Chicago, Johnson returns to Central Illinois next week for shows in Champaign-Urbana and Peoria. GLT's John Norton caught up with Johnson via Skype to talk about and play songs from Johnson's just-released album, American Dumpster.
We're nowhere near the end. For all you know, you'll never speak another word again. In the fire that is your friend.
The song you're hearing is the title track and lead track to the new album from Jesse W. Johnson. It's called American Dumpster, and Jesse joins us from his home in Chicago. Is that where you are right now?
I'm actually in Springfield. I'm originally from Springfield, but I've been living up in Chicago for the past, like, 7 years.
Okay, well, let's talk about your music in general. A lot of folks make comparisons to maybe the 1980s or 90s with some of your music and, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, a whole bunch of different things. I hear even 1970s influences. The band Love, I don't know if you're familiar with that band, but John Stewart,
yeah.
Lakeshore Drive on some of your songs, even Fleetwood Mac. Are you a fan of the 70s music as well?
I definitely am. That's what I grew up on listening to with 70s stuff. I'm, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I listen to, obviously, I guess Beatles is a little bit earlier than that. But, yeah, a lot of that kind of stuff. And I love that kind of music. I love the tones and the sound and the recording techniques around that time. I feel like that's the golden age of vinyl and recording stuff. So I definitely, that's right on. I love 70s.
No gear that can be turned. No word.
It was your Primal Scream album, actually the EP you put out before American Dumpster, which I want to get to in just a sec. A lot of folks noted that you know the lyrics that you write are a little bit darker than the often bright melodic music that surround those words. How does that dichotomy happen? Is it your optimism showing with the music part of it, or do you just want to show a contrast that way?
That's a great question. You know, I don't really know. I remember when I was younger, people used to ask me why the lyrics and stuff were darker. And I don't really know. I guess it's just kind of what comes out for me. I try when I write, I don't really have something that I try to write about. If I do that, I never end up really liking what I write too much. It feels like I'm forcing it. So usually when I write, I just kind of let stuff come out, and then I'll go back and edit it later. But a lot of times it is a little bit darker. And, you know, I think music is it's a therapeutic thing for me. Maybe getting some of that stuff out is helpful for me and helps me smile on my day to day. But I definitely agree that having the music be a little bit more uplifting and brighter is super important to me, because I think, like, the marriage of that darker theme but brighter sound, I personally like stuff like that. You know, I don't want music to be a total drag. It's got to be a little bit catchy. So that's kind of where that comes from.
Well, let's talk about a really tough lyric, the song Kid in the Castle from American Dumpster. I'm a pen with no ink.
With no ink. A car with no gas.
And it goes on from there, and then it sort of finishes, I'm the trembling child scared half of their life.
Yeah.
Is that you? Is that you, or are you describing someone else, or is that what you're getting at when you're saying that earlier?
No, yeah, you're totally right on there. That's definitely me. Yeah, that song's very autobiographical. At first, I wasn't even really sure I wanted to record or release that song because it's really getting down to, you know, anxiety and stuff that I have. It's not super bad or anything, but it's definitely there and a presence in my life. It's torn open.
There's a kid in the castle.
Kid in the Castle is the name of the song from the new album American Dumpster. It's Jesse W. Johnson who just put this album out. And this is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. I want to play a little bit of the song called Stand a Smile before I ask you about it.
Maybe we're all alone. Maybe there's nothing wrong. And when you shine a light, the darkness will be gone. And I will be.
Now, this is a catchy song. My goodness, this may be the standout to my ears on the album as far as music. And to me, it sounds like an updated take on Carole King's You've Got a Friend. It's got a little more optimism to this song.
Yeah, definitely. I like that comparison a lot, and thank you. Yeah, this song is definitely, I would say it's probably the most upbeat on the record, and I agree. I kind of think of it as a kind of a standout track as well. I think this one is totally one where it's got a, like a darker lyric on top of a really upbeat, catchier tune, which is stuff that I really like, because if you listen to the, you know, to the words in there, it's like the lyric is talks about I will be there, and it's kind of like a ghost of someone that used to be in your life still hanging around, and that's a little creepy, of like someone you can't shake and feelings you can't shake about someone that used to be close to.
And this is a pithy little number as well. It goes by in what, almost just a couple of minutes? It's just, it's there and it's gone. And you're like, I want more. I'm just telling you, I want more.
I would rather do that than stick around too long, that's for sure.
Stand a Smile is the name of the song. Jesse W. Johnson is our guest. How about in general? You've said that you feel like if you just sing or just play guitar, you totally suck compared to when you're doing both together. It sounds like it's almost like twins trying to finish each other's sentences.
Yeah, that's a really cool way to think about it. I'm self-taught on guitar, and I did take some vocal lessons and stuff, but I'm, you know, largely just self-taught there too. But you know, I never just played guitar or just sang, really. I started singing when I was playing guitar, and I, you know, vice versa. I think really what it is my whole sense of rhythm comes from the marriage of playing and singing at the same time. So when I don't do one and I try to do one on its own, I think my rhythm gets kind of thrown off. But I also think that when I'm just playing guitar and not singing, I'm concentrating too hard on playing guitar, and I'm like worried about messing up, and that's when I'll mess up, is when I'm, you know.
Let's play one more song from American Dumpster here. This is called The Miles in Your Eyes.
Don't let them cast me an outlaw when I've long paid for my crimes. And don't let them turn me into something.
Jesse W. Johnson is who you're listening to. The Miles in Your Eyes, Jesse, from American Dumpster. A little bit different musically from Stand a Smile, but still just a standout song. What are you getting at lyrically here?
This was a song that came out very quickly for me. I barely remember writing it. When I think about this song, I was thinking about if I were to die, you know, what would my legacy be? How would I be remembered, kind of thing? And I think, you know, everybody thinks about that, I would think, at some time. And I, in this song, I was just thinking about the meaning of my life and the meaning of life that nobody really knows what it is. And I was just, it's just kind of a meditation on that. And I think the feeling of the song for me is like feeling of satisfaction in not knowing that information, but also feeling satisfied with your life and the people around you and how you would be remembered.
And I don't know why.
Johnson. Springfield native, lives now in Chicago. American Dumpster is the great follow-up to Primal Scream. This is phenomenal, Jesse. Congratulations on this release.
Well, thanks so much, John. It's really exciting, and it's great to talk to you.
Jesse W. Johnson plays the Cowboy Monkey in Champaign July 21st. He'll play the Butternut Hut in Springfield July 22nd, and he'll be at the Rail 2 in Peoria July 29th. You hear Sound Ideas each weekday on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast or individual interviews today from Judy Valente, Ryan Denham, and Laura Kennedy. WGLT.org is also where you can find contact information to let us know what you think of this show, or share your thoughts at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
On the hospital bed, whispered these lies to you. When you step out onto a cloud, you know you're gonna fall.
This is GLT 89.1 FM, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.